So I'd like to introduce our speaker now. Kim Stern is an activist currently at the ANU. He has led in the past as the National Union of Students LGBTI officer, an impressive campaign that's still ongoing to let Commonwealth Games athletes stay in the country, be given a visa to stay here because they've overstayed because they're facing political persecution or other kinds of persecution in their country. So that's an ongoing campaign that Kim has been involved in leading. So Kim will speak for about 35 minutes. After that, we'll have plenty of time for discussion, contributions, questions, all sorts of things. So please make a note of them and welcome Kim.
Well, this talk is billed as a history of like a Western intervention in Iraq. I'm going to focus on the 2003 US-led invasion and subsequent occupation. But it's worth starting with the fact that the entire 100-year history of the Iraqi state and society has been marked by intervention, coercion, and manipulation by a coalition of Western powers. In fact, Iraq was an invention by the victors of the First World War. The British and the French carved up the crumbling Ottoman Empire, which was a vast college of various different cultural groups that had lived with little conflict between them for hundreds of years. For the new imperial administrators, the Middle East was a region of great strategic importance. Whoever controlled the region controlled the Suez Canal and other important trade routes. The discovery of massive depositories of oil only further excited their interest for control. Now, from the beginning, at no point were the wishes of the masses of people that lived in the area ever considered, and that's a theme that defines the subsequent history of the country and the region. Arbitrary lines were drawn on a map during a meeting between British Colonel Mark Sykes and French diplomat François-Georges Picot in 1915. Out of these negotiations, the old region of Mesopotamia became Iraq. A king who was originally meant for Syria, but was rejected out of fear of revolt, settled into Iraq as a loyal puppet for the British interests. From there, a militant wave of revolts in these new colonies fought for control over their own destinies. That was tied up with the Russian Revolution and a whole wave of anti-colonial revolts. They were brutally crushed by a comprador class of ruling elites, who were happy to collaborate with the West in return for a position of power and a cut of the wealth. Moving on to following like the Second World War, British imperialism was no longer as strong, you know, as it took. It was no longer strong enough to maintain its grip on the world. Taking inspiration from anti-colonial struggles across the globe, and especially the successful ousting of British rule in Egypt, a group of military officers began planning their own nationalist movement in Iraq. They managed to unite all oppositional sections in society into an anti-sectarian nationalist movement that overthrew the imposed monarchy in 1958. Socialist ideas were in the air, and the Communist Party of Iraq gained a significant audience. But more conservative forces dominated that movement. This meant that the new Iraqi Republic oversaw the development of capitalist society free from foreign interference, and that benefited mainly the army officers who took power. Even the sniff of communism was enough for America, who were now the new global empire, to panic and intervene. They wanted to favour the conditions for a bulwark against any further social upheavals in the USSR. So in 1963, the Ba'athist Party executed a successful coup against the popular government and carried out a brutal massacre of communists, socialists, intellectuals, journalists and activists. That was done with intelligence and lists provided by the Americans. So out of successive power struggles emerged a strong state-controlled economy headed by the Ba'athist Party and led by Saddam Hussein. I think it's worth going over just how useful a friend to American imperialism Saddam Hussein was before the 1990s, because it really does expose so much of the lies used to justify the invasion in 2003. So the American keepers of world peace were more than happy to encourage Iraq to go to war with Iran after an aborted revolution there installed an anti-American regime. During this war that raged for 8 years from 1980, the American administrations gave significant financial support and diplomatic cover to Saddam Hussein. They supplied arms and they did nothing to stop chemical weapons used to produce mustard gas and nerve agents entering Iraq. In 1988, these weapons were used to slaughter around 5,000 Kurds in the city of Halabja. This atrocity was originally denied, then downplayed by America, despite international outcry, until the West needed a humanitarian excuse to launch a war in 2003. It was only then that this horrific massacre transformed from an inconvenient detail by an Allied government into proof Saddam Hussein was a monster and an evidence of his willingness to launch a nuclear war on the West. So the American bastions of freedom only took issue with Iraq when it invaded Kuwait in 1990. Here Saddam Hussein overstepped his place in their network of friendly dictators and posed a threat to American control in the Middle East. Now that Iraq was seen as a rogue state, Hussein became an untrustworthy tyrant in need of discipline and defeat in the eyes of Washington. The first Gulf War was short and sharp. The US military's might overpowered Iraq's army and foiled their invasion of Kuwait. However, it was ordinary Iraqis who suffered the most. So during the bombing campaign, much of Iraq's infrastructure was deliberately targeted and blown to smithereens. From 1991, America imposed crippling sanctions on their new enemy. I think the example of pencils being banned from entry into Iraq because the lead that they contained could potentially be stripped and used to coat fighter jets gives a bit of a sense of just how punitive these sanctions were. The UN estimated that 500,000 children died during this period thanks to the sanctions and sanctions on medical supplies alone. Crucial infrastructure, the standard of living, these all took a huge hit from the bombing and the sanctions. For America, in the words of the then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the price was worth it. I think that's a quote worth keeping in mind if you ever find yourself reading her new book on Trump and fascism. Okay, so before 9/11, you can sort of get a sense that America, before 9/11 and 2003, the West had already, you know, really asserted its control and influence in Iraq on the society and on the kind of state that existed there. Empires have a whole range of ways that they do this, from political aid, from intelligence, economic incentives and coercion, that kind of thing. I think the most obvious and damning is military invasion. And I think nothing showed that more clearly than 2003. Just before going into that, I think to understand the significance of that invasion, both in terms of the people that most affected inside of Iraq, but also the monumental geopolitical consequences it had outside, some analysis is required of the world situation leading up to it. So with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, America emerged from the Cold War as the sort of unrivaled global superpower economically and militarily. It was a unipolar moment that foreign policy strategists concerned with securing the state of affairs were keen to capitalize on. People might have heard of the neoconservatives, this sort of brand of American politician. They set up a group called the Project for a New American Century that was established in 1997 as a think tank designed to win over the American ruling class to an interventionist foreign policy aimed at securing America's place at the top of the world pecking order. It argued for America to ramp up its military conflicts to initiate a series of regime changes. So to quote one of its papers, at no time in history has the international security order been more conducive to American interests and ideals. The challenge for the coming century is to preserve and enhance this American peace. Yet, unless the United States maintains sufficient military strength, this opportunity will be lost. So this obviously meant projecting power in one of the key areas of world capitalism, and that were the oil-rich countries in the Middle East. So many anti-war activists saw the invasion of Iraq as a war primarily for oil. The people like Dick Cheney, who's the ex-CEO of multinational Halliburton, were simply in it for more barrels of oil. And I think while oil was clearly a big factor in making Iraq and the region extremely important, the sort of popular US troops in, you know, invade anything that contains oil memes you sort of see on the internet these days, they sort of only explain half the story. I think along with keeping a cheap and large flow of oil, America wanted to achieve four things. The first was to keep Russia and China, the two growing powers, in check and frustrate their efforts to make inroads into the region. The second was to maintain its prestige as global hegemon through a display of unrivaled military power. The third was to get rid of Saddam Hussein, because having an outspoken critic of American power was a blight on their image, and regime change through sanctions clearly hadn't worked. And the fourth, the neocons also wanted to use Iraq as a stepping stone for further interventions and regime changes in the region, particularly in Iran. So the neocons behind the grand plan weren't just a few mad hatters who led America down the garden path against their better interests. They did wage an argument to the ruling class of America. They did win that argument after, you know, the terrorist attack on September 11, 2001 created an opportunity to intervene into the Middle East. But they were able to win this argument because there was a logic behind it. They actually said that this was in the interest of American capitalism as a whole. I think this is best summed up in an interview given by Condoleezza Rice at the time. So after, you know, while the world was sort of grieving from 9/11, she said 9/11 had started shifting the tectonic plates of international politics. And it's an important it's important to try to seize on that and position American interests and institutions and all of that before they harden again. And I think there's a few clear examples of how inter-imperialist rivalry with a drive towards military conflict is built into the logic of capitalism. Now, I don't have time to go through like the Marxist understanding of imperialism and how I think Iraq proves its usefulness compared to sort of rival theories, especially ones that were popular at the time. That's something that people might want to take up in the discussion. Okay. The Americans predicted a swift intervention to precipitate a quick regime change, turning Iraq into a neoliberal heaven on earth for American-based transnational oil and gas corporations and a secure home for American military bases to launch further expeditions into neighbouring countries. For this, they wanted a spectacular show of force. They really wanted to pull out all the stops. They started to design a thing called the Shock and Awe Doctrine. So in the words of its architect, they wanted to achieve a simultaneous effect, rather like the nuclear weapons at Hiroshima, not taking days or weeks, but in minutes. In 2, 3, 4, 5 days, they physically, emotionally, and psychologically are exhausted. Okay, and it's worth saying as well, the Australian government helped at every step of the way. Eager to impress their sort of bigger partner in the Australian-US alliance, the then Prime Minister John Howard backed plans to invade Afghanistan and Iraq. Australia gave diplomatic support on the world stage. They provided thousands of soldiers, military, intelligence, and logistical supports to this end. The government here wasn't dragged into this conflict unwillingly. It wasn't the result of Howard, you know, being a coward, as it's sometimes remembered. The Australian ruler class eagerly participated in the bloodshed because it saw America's imperial interests align with theirs. It helped out in a war halfway around the globe so it could call favours in the Asia-Pacific region as well, which it sees as its backyard. There was, of course, a big problem with this plan. While 9/11 gave an easy enough pretext to invade Afghanistan, there were actually zero links between Iraq and the al-Qaeda cadre behind the terrorist attack. The American government's propaganda machines in the State Department, the CIA and the FBI and all those connected agencies sprang into action. They churned out myriad lies and justifications for a whole-scale intervention in Iraq. And this culminated in Colin Powell's notorious speech to a special session of the United Nations Security Council, proving that the Ba'athist regime was building up weapons of mass destruction. Okay, however, the right-wing media and official government propaganda wasn't actually enough to generate support and legitimacy for the biggest military mobilisation since Vietnam. A key element for support for the invasion came in the guise of humanitarian intervention, which had the backing and cheering on from the liberal establishment in the West. So this included liberal newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, and the Fairfax Media here. They like to see themselves as the sort of independent free press, as a pillar for any healthy, functioning democracy. They now moan the rise of fake news, of alternative facts, and sort of bemoan the unprecedented levels of mistrust in mainstream media. Well, in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, they went along with all of the war cries from the establishment. They reprinted government and CIA sources as fact. They drummed up hatred of Saddam Hussein and in a way that no one did when he was an ally for the West, and they spoke of the moral obligation to help the Iraqi people rid themselves of their tyrant. Along with this, a whole genre of political nonfiction was invented by liberals who wrote book after book insisting they imposed old-fashioned Yankee imperialism, of course, but this was different. This was now a civilizational battle between Enlightenment thought and democracy on the one side and religious fundamentalism and barbarism on the other. Christopher Hitchens, a very prominent intellectual who actually started, started his career as a Trotskyist, led the charge. He regurgitated and legitimised the government's lies of weapons of mass destruction and the Ba'athist regime's link to al-Qaeda. He added that the invading armies will be greeted as liberators. He played a key role in chastising the protesters against the war, basically saying that they all supported Saddam Hussein and wanted his personal torture camps to continue. Another prominent liberal expressed it like this. He explained that his discomfort with siding with someone like George Bush in this instance, but he said that in this case, that he explained the case for empire is that it has become in places like Iraq the last hope for democracy and stability alike. And I think that last quote really gets to the heart of why there was so much Liberal support. It wasn't just that there were a few wrong predictions by a few individuals, but I think it speaks to a broader problem of liberalism. These justifications had in common a belief that capitalist institutions, like even the US Army, could potentially play a progressive role in the world. I think coupled with that was the belief that ordinary people, in this case ordinary Iraqis living under a dictatorship, are only victims of society, who need to be saved by an external force. The massive humanity can never be agents of change capable of leading a transformation of the world around them. So these liberals drew on hundreds of years of mystification of the Orient and decades of intense Islamophobic tropes about Arab culture to mount a case that democracy and civilization can only come from without. This has been pretty well laid out in a book by Richard Seymour called A Liberal Defense of Murder. So if you want to read more about that, I really recommend picking up that book. I think it's worth noting at this point that not everyone bought the lies of the Western powers either. Millions around the world opposed the impending invasion of Iraq. Millions took to the streets on February 15th of 2003 for internationally coordinated protests, specifically against the invasion. But it takes more than a demonstration of opposition to stop a war. Unfortunately, much of this anger was turned into bitter cynicism when on the March 20, the Coalition of the Willing rained bombs on Baghdad, starting a brutal war and occupation of Iraq, which led to the loss of 1 million lives, the displacement of millions more, and kicked off the spiralling vortex of misery and conflict that's still plaguing much of Iraq today. The footage of bombs raining down on Baghdad sort of seared into the memories of everyone who saw it broadcast around the world. It was a real decisive moment in world politics, but also a decisive moment that turned many into opponents of a system that compels such horror. The Ba'athist regime, having very limited military power and certainly no weapons of mass destruction with which it might defend itself, fell within a matter of weeks. So there was good reason for the optimism amongst the American war hawks. For whom, you know, the 6,000 innocent civilians who were bombed to smithereens in the first month factored not into their assessment. Mission successful, declared President Bush shortly after. But this apparent realisation of the sort of neocons' grand vision quickly degenerated into a decade-long occupation, resulting in a quagmire of destruction and protracted multifaceted armed conflict. So to understand how this happened, I just want to sort of outline three factors before summing up. So the first is the savagery of the initial invasion and occupation itself. The second is going to be the resistance by almost every section of Iraqi society in response to that invasion. And the third will be the subsequent response from the West and the religious and the regional powers to this resistance. So to look at the invasion itself, the goal wasn't just to topple Saddam Hussein. It was to completely eradicate the state-managed economy and prime the country for neoliberal plunder and accommodation to prepare it for accommodation to a permanent American presence. So during the looting that happened in the wake of the collapse of the Iraqi state, there were only two government embassies that weren't completely cleared out. They were the Ministry of Internal Affairs and the Ministry of Oil. They were the only two ministries that the US guarded with their army. So this was imperialism in the epoch of neoliberal economics, as Tariq Ali puts it. So a contradiction long inherent in neoliberalism became a key feature for US foreign policy in Iraq that changed based on principles of the free market required enforcement by an authoritarian state. So Paul Bremer, who led the coalition provisional authority, reduced the minimum wage, removed key tariffs on imported goods, announced a program of privatization of public enterprises, invited foreign companies to enter Iraq with full rights to repatriate profits, and eliminated the Ba'athist system of graduated income tax, cutting corporate tax rate from 40 to 50%, which is the same rate paid by the massive Iraqis. So from the very beginning, the invasion was never actually about establishing a democracy with a healthy economy, as it's sometimes put, but it was actually about the political and economic domination by the West. So while this meant privatising the economy, at the same time it meant taking over the repressive functions of the Iraqi state. The US Army forcefully took over schools, hospitals, government buildings and set up bases without a second thought for the wishes of the Iraqi people. The US would not tolerate opposition to any of its reforms. So Paul Bremer said, "We dominate the scene and we will continue to impose our will on this country." So much for the bringers of freedom and democracy. Okay, Abu Ghraib was an infamous Ba'athist prison complex to store, torture and murder political enemies of the regime. The US simply took over this facility and used it to detain any opposition to the occupation. And I think the leaked footage of torture by American soldiers in the prison wasn't the result of a few sick individuals that happened to find their way into the army, but flowed directly from the attitude and orders given by the occupying forces. The US brought in the head of its Guantanamo Bay prison camp, Major General Jeffrey Millers, to head up the torture regime. Millers told his second-in-command to treat the prisoners like dogs. He said that if you allow them to believe at any point that they're more than a dog, then you've lost control of them. So added to this was the ongoing capturing and recapturing of towns and provinces, of military expeditions to capture dissidents, and the incidental daily violence that are part and parcel of occupation. This daily drumbeat of small, deadly confrontations, punctuated by occasional high-profile citywide search-and-destroy operations, was at the heart of the process, which would generate 60,000 US-caused deaths in the first 14 months, and that would contribute a disproportionate share of more than 1 million deaths in the first 50 months. Okay, I want to turn to the resistance now. So all these factors contributed to the systematic alienation of Iraqi society to the occupying forces. There was resistance on a mass scale. The sort of liberal supporters of invention didn't just miss the mark when they said that the US Army could be the bringers of democracy and liberation. Their steadfast belief in the incapacity of ordinary people to challenge and repel dictatorial rule was also proven false. When within about a year, most of the country was outside the control of the occupying forces, and the interim national premier was basically reduced to the mayor of Baghdad. We owe it to the heroic resistance by Iraqis for disrupting America's plan for Iraq and therefore their goal of regime change and domination in the region. There was no victory for the Iraqi people in the same way that you can point to one in Vietnam or Algeria, but there was absolutely no American victory. This had world historic ramifications for American imperialism. It was the first step of their weakening position in the region. So this resistance was then and still now is framed in the media and by Western governments as foreign fighters and sort of Al-Qaeda terrorists. This was a way to ignore or at least undermine the unanimous hostility to the occupation. However, the national character of the resistance was in large part mediated through religious institutions. This allowed the resistance, firstly, to be portrayed as simply a religious conflict, and secondly, it did open it up to manipulation by forces who would benefit from sectarianism. So I think it's worth just quickly clarifying the role religion played in the resistance. So Saddam Hussein had relied on stoking religious divisions during his reign. He aligned the Ba'athist Party with the Sunni minority, giving them certain privileges in the state structures. But it wasn't actually a big part of people's lives. There were sort of interfaith marriages and communities lived in very little conflict between them. After the invasion, Sunnis were alienated from the new regime. The West installed a Shia favouring government that set up armed checkpoints across Baghdad and the surrounding Sunni majority area in order to eradicate the last vestiges of the old order. The Sunni ruling class started organising towards an armed resistance. But it's worth saying resentment was also spread to to Shia areas when they quickly realised that the occupying power had no concern for Iraqi self-determination. Shia clerical leader Muqtada al-Sadr began agitating amongst poor Shias and began constructing an army outside the control of the installed government. So mosques and religious institutions became the natural organising and governing centres following the collapse of the Iraqi state. And that was sort of further emphasised with the lack of any sort of secular institutions or a left that was able to play that role. But religious divisions actually weren't the key dynamic at this point at all. Polls held in Iraq from August to September 2003 showed that only 29% of Iraqis believed it was important that a political leader should represent their sect. Many Iraqis were uncomfortable identifying themselves as Sunni or Shia, preferring to describe themselves as just Muslim. In 2004, there was a citywide uprising in Fallujah. The Sunni city's schools had been occupied by American soldiers. Peaceful demonstrations had been met with gunfire. And the local ad hoc governing council declared its political opposition to Baghdad. In response, the American army unleashed Operation Phantom Fury. It bombed the city with shellfire, door-to-door combat, and indiscriminate bombing, including the use of missiles dipped in depleted uranium. Now, this form of collective punishment wasn't to save the city from foreign insurgents, but it was designed to send a message to any group in Iraq wanting to resist the occupation. I think Fallujah is significant because there was solidarity shown by Shia leaders. Muqtada al-Sadr condemned the massacre, railway workers refused to load and drive trains aiding the assault, and on walls throughout Iraq there was graffiti such as like Sunni plus Shia equals jihad against the occupation. So I think this potential for a united non-sectarian national resistance movement more than anything else, sent shivers down the spine of the installed government there. So I just want to look at their response quickly as well. Their immediate response was twofold. On the one hand, they simply just ramped up repression, and on the other hand, they sought to divide and weaken their opposition by fostering sectarianism. But the troops were never actually able to eradicate the insurgents. No matter how many cordon sweep operations, no matter how many homes, schools and hospitals were bombed, because the resistance didn't come from a small minority of foreign fighters. Instead, in every township, every city, and in every region, the fighters were had either active or complicit support from much of the Iraqi population. The tactic of divide and rule took many forms. So firstly, when they finally conceded in calling elections, they intentionally laid out the rules to benefit the Shia majority. The form of government they installed entrenched religious divisions by helping construct a confessional state whereby political power and distribution of resources is intimately tied up with religious networks of patriotage. So to quote a study on this, Sunni Arabs and Shias now had to sell themselves on the basis of sectarian identity if they wanted employment from the coalition. Political leaders had to become sectarian entrepreneurs. So it's in this context that right-wing sectarian Sunni groups intervened, carrying out terrorist attacks on Shia communities. There was condemnation from Sunnis and Shias alike, but they were drowned out as this dynamic of sectarian conflict escalated. It resulted in a semi-fascist Shia faction controlling the state apparatus with American support against an extremely disenfranchised and sectarian Sunni ruling groups. This led to a bloody civil war between the rival factions of the ruling class that played off and increased the sort of religious hostility and the fracturing of what was left in Iraqi society. So despite many efforts by the Bush administration and the Obama administration, America officially withdrew most of its troops in 2011, admitting defeat. It left behind a country materially devastated and incomprehensibly divided without achieving any of its strategic aims. I think this history is important to remember now because it explains how sectarianism has become actually inbuilt into the structures of capitalism in the Middle East. The sort of violent dynamic of divide and rule being deployed by the invading powers and then fortified and escalated by the sort of the ruling classes there, I think that is the key dynamic that led to the Iraq we see today. So sectarianism is obviously not something inherent in Arab culture, but it's also just not some hangover from feudalism. I think it should be understood as more than just rhetoric used by autocratic leaders, but sectarianism has actually become an integrated part of the social relations of capitalism in Iraq. So add to this the interventionist role of Iran, who was sort of ironically the main benefactors of the collapse of Saddam Hussein. They backed the Shia government and provided military assistance against the Sunni rebels and ISIS, and we start to actually complete a picture of the divisions and conflicting players that make up Iraq today. So the meddling of other regional powers is an important contributing factor, I'll just quickly say. So Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey and Russia have increased their involvement and backed various different sectarian forces. So while America is still, you know, the number one force to blame and still the world's most powerful military power, it's not the only force responsible for the current state of affairs in the Middle East. I want to sum up now by just drawing out some lessons from this history for today. I think the first lesson is that Western intervention into Iraq or anywhere, is always driven by empire building and imperial control. It has nothing to do with democracy and global security. The invasion and occupation in Iraq has actually made the world a more insecure, unstable and violent place. It overrode any democratic say in the region and in the West. This required unfathomable amounts of violence and lies. The recent extradition attempt of Julian Assange to America for the crimes of helping expose the sort of systemic savagery and barbarism in Afghanistan and Iraq is testament to this. Basically, every single one of the justifications used to invade Iraq have been proven to be complete lies. And I think another lesson is, when tested, all capitalist institutions, including the media and the liberal establishment, fell into line and aided the war effort. Opposition to an invasion can't be relied on them, but it also needs to go beyond a single demonstration to stop a war. I think we should remember why the invasion wasn't a success for America as well. As is often the case in history, the activity of the masses, their refusal to submit to decisions they had no part in making, the heroism of their resistance forced the mightiest power on earth to stumble. But it hasn't led to an improvement for those in the Middle East, in Iraq in particular. I think freedom and justice will only come to those in Iraq in a mass movement that challenges the imperial powers, but also their own ruling classes. The massive strikes against corruption and sectarianism in Iraq, which have been happening over December and the start of this year, and now obviously the revolutions that are striding forward in Algeria and Sudan, I think point to a way out of this deeply entrenched sectarianism and towards a Middle East worthy for those living in it. So lastly, I just want to say, when so much of the political analysis of the world today sort of paints the anti-establishment right, like people like Donald Trump and Bolsonaro, as the single causes for violence, racism and war, we have to remember that all of this happened under the establishment and under the liberal world order. In fact, it was their actions in power that laid the basis for the political crisis unfolding today. This includes the insurgent far right, who have simply taken up the post 9/11 political framing of like Western civilization versus Islam and carried it out on the streets of Melbourne, the mosques in Christchurch, and the ballot boxes the world over. So I think the need to oppose the establishment's drive towards war, to stand in solidarity with anti-imperialist struggles and against all the racism and nationalism that underpin this system, is more urgent than ever. Thanks.